praying more. I'm learning about dependence on God. I'm learning that of my own strength and wisdom, I am nothing. I'm learning to trust. And I don't think that could have happened for me personally in another way, if I was along another path.
Chris Vai is a Presbyterian pastor currently living in Southern Ontario. He's living with a fatal disease called ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. On this edition of Listening In Audio Magazine, you'll hear Chris reflect on weakness, journey, and the name of our God. I also talked to John Stackhouse about the possibility of God's trustworthiness despite appearances to the contrary, Lydia Harms, uttering the unutterable, Jamie Howison on broken books and broken music, and finally Alf Bell on the church's responsibility to be a safe place for the broken. You will also hear music from Bruce Colburn, Glenn Soderholm, Lou Reed, and yours truly. This is Volume 2 of Listening In Audio Magazine. I'm your host, Steve Bell. I had a dream once that I was in a large room, a massive room. Probably the better word to use is an eternal room, and it was full of people, all sitting on the ground, and we all had blankets over us, and the air was chilly, and we were warm, though, because of our blankets, and there was a light, like a fireside flickering glow on all the faces, although I can't recall there was any fire. And everybody was facing the front of the room, although, of course, there can be no front in eternal room, but it was a dream. And at the front was God. And God was sitting as well on the floor. And God as well had a blanket. And God was bigger than the rest of us. And God was typically, in my dream, it was an old, large man, very, very nice and grandfatherly looking. And I was sitting on his lap in the crux of his arm under his blanket, looking out at all the rest. And I remember quite distinctly that I wasn't sitting there because I was special. I was just sitting there because it was my turn. And somehow I knew that we all got a turn to sit there. And we're all sitting in quiet. And it was the most beautiful silence, just enjoying the glow more than anything. And the room, although it was huge and massive, and there was just hundreds and thousands of, or maybe possibly millions of people there, as dreams work, no matter where I looked in the room, whoever's face I zeroed in on immediately became very, very present and close. So it had this sort of this magical ability that everybody was in close proximity in a bizarre way. And we're sitting in quiet, and we're enjoying the glow, and enjoying the silence, and basking is about the only way I can describe it. But at one point, I started to hear sniffling, and I looked around the room, and I could tell that somebody was having emotions of some sort and was holding back tears. And then finally, I zeroed in on a middle-aged woman, and she was obviously struggling with something and trying to hold it back because she felt maybe it was inappropriate. After some time, she finally stood up rather tentatively and began to speak and started to tell all of us, but God in particular, about her son, who is in some sort of trouble. I believe he was in trouble with the law, and there was drugs involved, and he was in trouble, and her heart was broken. And through these tears, she begged God to intervene on behalf of her son. And I remember looking up into the face of God, whose face was very close to mine, waiting in anticipation for what he was going to say to her. And he looked at her without speaking, very passionate eyes, but sort of just nodded to her as if to say, well, I knew that already. But he didn't say anything. And she became flustered eventually and sat down a little embarrassed and maybe even a little humiliated that she hadn't been responded to in a way that we all thought she should. And I was a little perplexed by this, but we went back to our glow and not quite so warm. A few minutes later, a man stood up, and he was from Ethiopia. And at that time, there had been a famine in Ethiopia, and his people were destitute. And he stood up, and through his tears and through his anguish, he told the story of his people and of the children. He described their racked bodies and begged God to intervene. And I looked up to the face of God, which was very close to mine, waiting in anticipation for his answer. And he sort of nodded as if to say, I already knew that. And the man eventually sat down awkwardly. And one by one, people started around the room standing up and telling their tales. And each time, God would not respond. He would just nod. And each time, they'd sit down. And as this went on, I went from being in a position of peace and comfort and basking to, to anger, actually. I remember looking at one point up at the face of God and thinking to myself, goodness, you have all the power. It's all in your hands and you're doing nothing. And I remember at one point starting to squirm and thinking to myself, I don't think I want to sit with him anymore. And after some time, I remember in the dream, this big tear welled up in the right eye, and I was on the right side, on the right eye of God, and it came tumbling down his cheek and kind of splashed off his chest, and I seem to actually remember a bit of it spattering on my face. And I thought, oh, finally, the giant has moved. And all of a sudden, all of us heard in our hearts, not so much in our ears, because his mouth never spoke. It was more something that we understood in our heart. And the voice said, if you knew what I knew, you'd sit still. But of course you don't, and you can't. And that's what my tears are about.
Concerned with mysteries of life that are yet untold, but I am still, and quiet is my soul, like a child whose mother holds. Yes, I am still, and just like a child is my soul, for as long as the sun, as long as the moon, his justice shall reign and cover the earth and ever into, and there shall be peace from sea to sea, for as long as the sun, as long as the moon to me.
John Stackhouse is professor of theology at Regent College in Vancouver, where he teaches Christianity and contemporary culture. In 1998, Oxford University Press published a book by John called Can God Be Trusted? It is an apologetic or a defense of the Christian faith against the apparently contradictory, perplexing, and personally agonizing problem of evil and suffering. This might sound like a daunting book to some, but I have read it several times and can assure you that it was written specifically for folks like us. In it, John argues that if the goodness and power of God can only be measured by the absence of suffering and evil, then clearly the Christian faith is absurdly naive and its God either impotent or irrelevant. But, he argues, if the goal of human existence is not eternal bliss, but rather love, then this just might be the best possible world after all, because for love to exist, there must be real freedom, and for freedom to exist without evil, there must be maturity. Maturity must come through process, and that process must allow for the possibility of evil and its consequences. John's respect for the delicate intricacies of the subject is evident throughout his book, as is his understanding and respect for other religions and perspectives. John's goal is to help us non-specialists think clearly about the whys and wherefores behind the disappointments and disasters we face. Therefore, he qualifies in his introduction, quote, people who are in the midst of grief or catastrophe or peril probably will find some of this book to be too abstract for them, too coolly distant from their immediate pain. What these people need instead is comfort, and especially the comfort of those who can truly sympathize. I offer this book instead to those who want to consider seriously the question of faith in God before crushing evil befalls them or someone they care about. I offer it to people who want to prepare themselves to face the reality of life, which includes the reality of evil, with as many intellectual tools in the cupboard as they can get. I offer it to those who are so offended by God's apparent mismanagement of the world that they cannot take faith in God seriously. And I offer it to people who have experienced bitter trouble and who long for a helping, hopeful word on the subject of faith in God. Close quote. Here's John Stackhouse in response to the question, "Can God be trusted?"
My 8-year-old son thinks that's an amusing question. When the book came out, Josh would like to say, "Can God be trusted?" knowing it was the title of the book. Say, "Yes, of course."
Yeah, that's the good, proper answer.
Well, it is the proper answer for an 8- or 9-year-old who's raised in a family that has enough to eat and mom and dad are around and family squabbles are over by bedtime.
Yeah,
God and the world seem like good places.
Right.
But I'm afraid for Josh that as he gets older, life will kick him in the head the way it kicks all of us in the head. And he, too, will have to ask that question again, and it will be a more difficult question to answer the next time, I think.
Right. I remember when I was, I grew up like your boy did in a very safe home, and, you know, I felt secure and loved, and I never once thought about if I was going to eat or, you know, we didn't have illnesses that were, you know, that were crippling or tragedies, really, you know, and so again, you know, I of course God can be trusted. I grew up in a very safe world, and my first crisis came in my mid-teens. I was driving my brother-in-law's motorcycle, and it was the first time on a motorcycle, and I was going around a corner on a gravel road about 5 miles an hour and wiped the thing out and broke my wrist.
Mm.
No big deal. I broke it, but it was painful. And I had
think of what a good guitar player you could be nowadays if you hadn't done that.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Can you imagine? Oh, I'd
be able to get that F chord.
Well, I remember that night lying in bed. I can't sleep. The pain is excruciating. And I'm thinking, I have a God, you know? And I couldn't for the life of me say any reason why he couldn't take away the pain. And I remember praying, just in total faith, "God, I believe you can do this. Could you please take away this pain?" And it didn't go away. And I prayed some more and fervently. And I totally did then and do now believe it's within the possibility. It didn't happen. By the end of the night, I was mad. I remember thinking to myself, "Well, if I can't trust you with this little thing, how am I supposed to trust you later with big things?"
That's a wonderful example of how we react to things like that, whether we're 8 or 48.
Yeah.
We think that the most important thing to have happen in that encounter is for the pain to go away. Our natural reaction is to say, suffering is the main problem, so alleviating suffering is the main solution.
Right.
But the biblical testimony is that suffering is sometimes a path, a necessary, ugly, even evil path, toward what we need to get. Jesus faced the indescribable suffering ahead of him on the cross. And he naturally asked God the Father in the Garden of Gethsemane, "Please take this pain away. I believe you can do it. Please don't make me drink of this cup."
Right.
"Nevertheless, your will, not mine, be done." And God said, "I'm not taking the pain away. You got to go." And Jesus got the message, and he went. As the letter to the Hebrews tells us, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross. He didn't dance through the crucifixion. He didn't have some kind of wonderful spiritual anesthesia. He agonized through it in order to get somewhere worth going to. And that, I think, is a crucial message that the Christian testimony gives us through the ages based on Scripture, that given our fallenness, given our situation of confusion and pain and sin, sometimes it's necessary for us to go through extraordinary difficulty to arrive home.
Right.
Plan A would have been to just walk straight home in the Garden of Eden.
Right.
But Plan A is not on anymore. Plan B is on, post-fall, post-curse. Right. And that often requires excruciating difficulties on the way home.
Right. I think we often equate suffering and evil.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and I was reading your book and stuff, and I'm thinking, you know, it just may be that those two are not different sides of the same coin. They might be two separate coins.
Well, I would say that suffering is evil. I think but suffering's part of what evil is, and it's not always the most important part. I think that God doesn't want us to suffer, ideally, and I think heaven will be bereft of suffering. I think that the promise is that every tear will be wiped away and there won't be any more tears. Now, I'm adding to the text, but I think that's the implication. So I think we can say that, yeah, suffering's bad, but it's necessary sometimes. There's nothing like laying a motorcycle down to teach you all kinds of valuable life lessons about physics and obeying the law and prudence and actions have consequences and so on. Now, if we could learn those lessons when we were eight, then we wouldn't be breaking hearts and breaking promises and breaking contracts and breaking all kinds of things later in life. Well, unfortunately, we don't always learn it at eight, so we have to keep laying down motorcycles at 18 and 28 and 38. But if we will attend to the pain, it'll tell us something. If we'll attend to the suffering and listen to it, it'll tell us something important about the way the world is and the way we are and how we should respond more positively to it. If God simply takes the pain away all the time, we don't learn, we don't grow, and of course he could, but that would mean the equivalent to me of sort of shooting us up with drugs that keep us from ever feeling any pain. But I don't know that we grow up, and that's the point, is growing up.
There is a question that has bothered me for some time. It concerns a story about my foster daughter and myself. Kendara came to us when she was 6 years old. Nancy and I had wanted to foster for some time and were excited to have her come and live with us. I had all sorts of romantic notions about how we would take in this poor waif, and I/we would love her to perfect health and maturity. Then Kenny showed up. She was an odd little girl who had already been in so many foster homes that the term mom and dad were applied to us at her first greeting. Her teeth were rotting and black, her manners were appalling, and in general, her mannerisms bugged me. And I was shocked at myself how difficult it was to love her. I remember, after several months, noticing that I was much harder on her than I was on my own kids, and so one night I begged God to help me love her. Sometime later, we started noticing a limp in Kenny's walk. It turned out that she had a tumor in her leg that would have to be removed, and the scariest part was that the doctors were not so sure she would even walk again after the operation. And I prayed for her. How could God let this happen to one who had already had experienced so many setbacks, and I was sure God would miraculously heal her as a sign of his care. But the operation day came, the doctors opened her up, and she emerged from the table with one less tumor and 80 new stitches. I stayed by her bed for 2 days and nights so that as she regained consciousness, every 4 hours at the end of the effects of the painkillers, she would have someone there. The pain was intense, and I've never felt so helpless as she would cry and beg me to help make it better. Kenny recovered with full use of her leg and the surprise and added bonus of a foster parent who had fallen in love with her in the process. But I remember the day it dawned on me that my prayer, asking God for the ability to love Kenny, had been answered at considerable cost to her. And I remember wondering in horror if God would actually require her to suffer so much for my deficiency.
I think that the ways of God are mysterious, and I think that that's one of the most important conclusions to come to, is that God's ways aren't our ways, and that God's ways are frightening sometimes.
Yeah.
That the scriptures often quote God through the prophets saying, I make weal and I make woe. That means I make the good things and I make the bad things. Yeah. That the buck stops at the divine desk.
Have you heard Monty Python's All Things Dull and Ugly?
Yes, I have, yes. And I was going to quote extensively from that later on in this interview, okay. But you beat me to it. You stole my thunder. But I'll return to the Bible if I can, okay. Steve. And it seems to me that we want to be careful about attributing sin to God and evil to God. We want to be very careful about that. But still, God, in the traditional Christian sense, sets up the show and maintains the show. So he's ultimately responsible for the way the show plays out. Now, I say this very carefully and with a sense of being on holy and frightening ground, but it is nothing for God to be able to take a tumor away. It seems to be much more complicated for God to open your heart to love or mine.
Right.
So the really interesting miracle is changing our spirits to become more Christ-like. The easy miracles, which I think show up in the life of Jesus, the easy miracles are feeding 5,000 or walking on water. I mean, it's sort of all on day's work. Big deal.
Yeah.
You do what you need to be
done.
It's
his stuff. You know,
Jesus takes 3 years to try to get his disciples to understand the basics of the kingdom of God, which they don't get until after the crucifixion and resurrection and finally the coming of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost.
Right.
That takes a long time
to
teach them the four spiritual laws and a few more things in a way that they can really grasp and go with. So I think that if you hold a traditional view of God, which I do, over against, for instance, a non-traditional view of God, like Rabbi Kushner's When Bad Things Happen to Good People, that says God really means to do well, he just can't. You know, he really wants to heal your daughter's leg, but for some reason he can't. With the traditional view of God, I say, yeah, he jolly well could heal your daughter's leg in a moment, so there must be a good reason why he doesn't. Now, that doesn't mean we're always going to know the good reason, but we can have assurance that God has a good reason. Now, why would that be? The central part of my own researches and reflection on this is simply to come back to the heart of the Bible, and that is the face of God, the part of God's revelation to us that shows us most clearly who God is and what God's like is Jesus Christ. So instead of thinking of God in some vague, transcendent, glorious, frightening, you know, guy on a throne terms, what about sitting in the hospital room as you're keeping vigil with your little one and imagining the Lord Jesus sitting with you? Can we really imagine Jesus Christ not caring about your wounded, pain-filled daughter? Can we really imagine him saying, you know, I actually don't care about this tumor. I'm don't bother me, or I'm busy, or I can't cope, or something. Mm. No, but we could imagine the Lord Jesus, I think, if we read the scriptures, saying, I have to do something surprising here that you may not like, but it's going to be a loving thing. Can you look into my face and believe that I do love you, even though I'm going to do something now that you may not understand and not like? And that something he may do is nothing, you know? He might just leave that tumor there. But can you... Well, I think I can. If I can visualize God as Jesus, then I think I have a lot to hang on to get me through those tough times. And that's what I think the Christian teaching about incarnation is about, among other things, is literally visualizing God in the face of Jesus.
God with us.
Well, very much so. And you see, if it's God in general... Boy, I don't know if God can be trusted, because God in general seems to do an awful lot of weird and even wicked things in the world.
Right.
But God reflected in the face of Jesus, to me, is indisputably good. That is a kind face. That's a loving face. That's a face of somebody who's going to hang in there for the long haul, who's willing to go to death and back for each of us.
Yeah.
If that's God, and traditional Christian teaching says it is, Jesus isn't just a good guy who gestures toward God or points toward God or tells us interesting things about God like prophets can do, but Jesus really is God in action, then I can be comforted. And I have had to go back to that, Steve, over and over again to be reassured that God is good and God is working and God's going to bring us home in the face of what is otherwise mysterious and frightening evil.
The first time I remember meeting Chris Vai was in a small dark basement bar in Winnipeg called the Zoo Lounge. This was back sometime around 1979. Chris and his buddies came out to see the band I was playing in and showed an unusual enthusiasm for our music, so quite naturally, admiring his taste, I came to enjoy his company anytime he turned up. Then years later, Chris resurfaced in my life. Now he was a Presbyterian pastor in southern Ontario. Chris was responsible for bringing me and my music into that region, and I've always been grateful for his support. To meet Chris is to like and respect him almost immediately. He's warm, jolly, thoughtful, and carries a quality of authenticity about him that sets him apart from many. Recently, however, Chris has been diagnosed with ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. ALS is a neuromuscular disorder, a rapidly progressive fatal disease that attacks the motor neurons, causing the body muscles to atrophy and die. In the last 2 years, we have seen Chris reduced in size and ability to the confinement of a wheelchair and the almost complete loss of intelligible speech. Chris was married to Susan, and they have one daughter, 2-year-old Claire. A while back, I had the opportunity to talk to Chris about his journey.
This whole notion of weakness fits into this, and I'm very excited about exploring this whole notion of being weak and getting weaker. It's a strange thing to say because there is fear in that as well and anxiety, but I'm also excited about going through that. I have to be careful because I don't want to sound flip or any,
right.
But what I'm thinking here is that I will become more Christ-like going through that.
In terms of the weakness?
Than I would being strong and healthy and able. Because Christ willingly emptied himself and became weak.
Right.
And to the point of...
To the point of death.
Death.
Yeah.
And suffering that none of us will ever know.
Yeah.
That kind of suffering is immense, what he went through. And then willingly died to the glory of God. And so I'm conscious of the fact that Christ has done it before me, and Christ is suffering with me.
Right.
And is getting weaker with me.
Right.
And so what I want to happen with my whole heart and soul is that I might become a witness. I might be someone who can point to Christ through this and reflect God's love, which is a powerful thing,
right,
to other people. And it's interesting, the word martyr. I've been thinking about this as well. In our modern English, it's become a term of like a denigrating sort of thing. You say, "Oh, you got a martyr complex," or
right,
"He thinks he's such a martyr," or "She thinks."
Yeah.
But if you look at the word in its original, in the Greek, it means a servant or a witness. And so,
I didn't know that.
To be a martyr is to be a witness, to point to Christ while you're dying. And
all of us
are dying, right?
Yeah.
But with me, it's a more immediate thing, and it's a more, it may happen more, may happen sooner than,
right,
I thought, sort of thing. So I know I'm conscious of my death, and I'm looking forward, looking ahead to what's going to be happening. So as that happens, I want to point to Christ while it's happening. And I think that redeems suffering and redeems death ultimately,
right,
and defeats death.
Okay, I'm going to ask you probably an irresponsible question. Then maybe this is as much as we need to get, but I don't even know if we'll use it or whatever. But are you sorry this has happened to you? Or would you wish it to not have happened?
I wouldn't want to change a thing. This is my this is my path,
right,
and my journey, and it's Susan's journey.
Yeah,
it's your journey.
Yeah,
and anyone who knows us and comes into contact with us, it's theirs as well. But we're all part of that, but it's not because of me, it's because of Christ. It's because we're one in Christ and we're brothers and sisters in Christ that we share that journey. And other people experience it in other ways, but I wouldn't want to change a thing. I wouldn't want to have come this far in my life in any different way whatsoever.
Okay.
And it's my story. I have to tell it. And it's part of the great story, which is God's story. And we're all part of that. And somehow, I wouldn't want it any different.
One of the benefits of having known Chris Vai over the years is that I got to meet one of his great friends, Glenn Soderholm, who is a Presbyterian pastor in Southern Ontario. He's also a wonderful singer and songwriter. And when Glenn heard about Chris's condition, he responded by writing this song. This is Glenn Soderholm.
I look up to the hills. Where does my strength come from? It comes from the one who has made heaven and earth. He won't let you stumble, for he will not sleep. He who keeps Israel will not slumber. The Lord is your keeper. Your side, under the sun and under the moonlight.
I often talk about, when I introduce a song, I often talk about the fact that this is a traveling song. This is for the pilgrims. What's one of the Psalms of Ascent? As the pilgrims make their way to Jerusalem.
Oh.
And yeah, and again, Eugene Peterson has this marvelous take on this, because he says, you know, when everyone thinks often in the beginning of that song, you know, my eyes, I look up to the hills, and where does my help come? It comes from the Lord, the maker of heaven and earth. They think, well, you look at nature, and it's this beautiful thing. But he says, in fact, when the travelers to Jerusalem looked up on the hills, what they saw were these pagan shrines and oracles who were offering them, like, quick fixes for a safe journey, you know? It's a traveling song. It's for weary pilgrims. It's for those who are struggling on the journey to Zion.
And maybe tempted to go for the quick fix.
Yeah, well, exactly. And the thing about the song, too, is when you look at it at first, the psalm, it seems to say that, you know, kind of when you trust in God, that you won't have troubles in the journey. But if you examine it more carefully, it's not what it's saying. It's just saying that God is with you in the journey.
Right.
Even through disease and coming to the point of death.
Lord will keep you, keep your life when you go out and when you return forevermore. Lord is your keeper, the shade at your side, under the sun and under the
Christians just love to tell stories of the saints who meet suffering with otherworldly peace and graciousness. These stories are legitimate and certainly need to be told, but there is a danger of over-sentimentalizing suffering. The truth is, some of us don't go so quietly into the night, and those stories need to be told as well. Lydia Harms lost her husband to cancer in September of 1993. Dawson's death left her with 4 children and not a whole lot of resources to raise them with. And she was not so gracious about the whole affair. In fact, and I've teased her since, that according to some standards, she behaved rather poorly. For example, at one point, someone attempted to console Lydia with the news that Dawson's death had resulted in the salvation of certain souls. And Lydia's public response was that she would trade those souls for her husband back in a minute. Oddly enough, I discovered for myself a strange hope in Lydia. Lydia was committed to telling the truth, even if it drew the anger of God, which I haven't seen any evidence of.
It happened at a supermarket, and it was my anniversary. Mm-hmm. And I didn't even realize it. I didn't even know why I was having such a bad day.
Right.
And it would have been the day that we would have been married, you know, 14, 15 years.
Right.
And I was struggling. And I go to the supermarket, and I meet Olaf in this supermarket, and I just, he just says, "What's up?" And I'm saying, "Oh, man, it's rough." And somehow we got talking about that whole deal. Someone had said to me either that day or the day before that, you know, they had just heard about somebody turning their life around that had been, you know, sitting beside Dawson while he was dying and receiving this amazing grace and just realizing, rethinking their own life. And this person who was telling me the story was just saying, isn't it amazing, you know, that his death produced
life.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. What we live for as Christians, you know.
Right.
And so, I was telling Olaf the story, and I said to him, I said, you know, I would trade every one of those souls to have him back here today. And
did you mean that?
Yeah, I did. I did. Yeah, huh. I really did. Facing life with four kids, extremely limited resources, and trying to head into, you know, carry on with life without him. At that point, that felt like a really big, tall order.
Yeah.
And it felt like someone's soul. There should have been another way to get that soul into heaven.
You would think.
You would think.
You would think. Yeah. Now, I don't want to lead you too much, but it seems to me, I mean, you were always good about it in many ways, but there were some blurts of rage that came out of you a few times. Yeah. Godward, were there not?
Yeah, lots.
Lots.
Lots and lots and lots. At the funeral, even planning the funeral, I remember saying to Paul, who led it, I said, not one resurrection text. Forget it. There might be something good in this, but I'm not there yet.
Right.
And that has to be saved and for later. And we didn't. And not because I don't believe that.
Right.
But I think I needed to experience that human desolation. I think it's the Jesus on the cross and him saying, "Why are you forsaking me?" And God just remaining silent. But he got to say it. And if the Son of God got to say,
"Why have you forsaken me?
Why are you forsaking me? Why?" Even the question. Like he was, it's almost like he didn't know. Does this have to be a part of the experience?
I never thought of that because he doesn't state a fact,
no.
"You have forsaken me." He asks, "Why?
Why?"
I never thought of that.
Why does it have to get this dark? Does it have to? And God is just silent. And for all of my raging, and I did a lot of it, I said things to people that, and I found them all. I mean, there's a few out there. If somebody knows about them, I'm sure they'll find me now and remind me of things I said. But as I healed and as I moved from that place, God gave me opportunity to be with those people in one form or another. Some of them have taken years, and I found them in a circumstance and said, you know, I said that. And I'm sorry about that. And someone wished me all the best at the funeral. I looked at them, I said, "All the best?" I said, "I just buried it."
Right.
And he just kind of was shocked. And I did find him after.
You took it well.
Yeah. I remember challenging people, particularly ministers who would come and try to do the "Lord is my shepherd" and things, you know, with Dawson, and just kind of that leading and that, or just that sense of security, providing that to him. And, oh, I challenged them. "You're a minister. I read in the Word of God, it says you heal the sick, you raise the dead." I said, "How many people are you doing that to?" "Noel." I never met one.
Right.
And you know, oh, then I would challenge their vocation. "You sure you're in the right deal, eh? Like, 'cause don't match."
Wow. Wow. I remember several years ago, I met a woman, and she told me she had had a very, very difficult life, and it was her children had some disabilities that had meant that the rest of her life was going to be pretty rough. And as she's telling me her story, of course, I don't know if it's a guy thing or whatever, but all I'm thinking about is I need to put a salve on this. And that's why she's telling me this story. I need to give her a reason, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff. And mm-hmm. so I made some lame comment about how God chooses some people to really develop character through mm-hmm. suffering. Yeah. Something like that, I remember. And I was just grasping, of course. I had no idea. Well, I thought she was going to slice my throat. And she just looked at me and said, "Don't you dare."
That's right.
You know, and I remember stepping back and not knowing how to respond. Mm-hmm. Do you think the church is comfortable with the rage? Do we have enough places for you to go?
Because of the experience with Grain of Wheat, and because I worship...
Grain of Wheat is a church that you're attending. Yeah.
In a place that's... And I would say it's an alternative option to church, as a lot of people would understand it,
right.
And there was,
and, there, and I, there was what?
There was an opportunity for me,
okay.
to walk out on the parts that I couldn't handle.
Yeah,
there was an opportunity for me to grieve and to be honest and to share what I was really feeling.
And the ugly stuff.
The ugly stuff.
Okay.
Yeah, and I think in general, It's a really difficult thing for people who have grown up in homes that suggest if you do these things, and they are worship, live right, you know, pray, do all those things, God is going to treat you different because you are now one of His.
Right.
And so when you suffer, there's a perception that just because you have God with you, when you suffer, when you are asked to walk through these things, that you...
Somehow it's easier.
And it is categorically not.
Right.
It is not. There is not one thing, not one human experience around a loss that you will not feel and face, whether you believe in God or not.
Hmm.
And that was shocking.
That was news to you?
That was news to me.
Right.
I've walked real close with a number of people whose faith is not what mine is or where mine is at. And I have not been spared a single thing.
Is that right?
I have felt every single thing that they have felt. The loneliness, the desolation, the rejection, all those experiences common to... people kind. That's the verse that comes to me, you know, all temptation. Like it talks to
right.
about Jesus that way. He experienced every one of them. That is exactly right.
Okay.
You do not, God or no.
Right.
You do not escape any of the human experience around it. And that's where the rage comes from. That's the spot of the rage.
Because it's supposed to be different.
Absolutely.
I believe,
absolutely.
I trust, it should be different.
That's why the rage is not directed at the cancer. It's not directed at the hospital or the sickness or somebody didn't do their thing. My rage is against God because I know He's the bottom line, and
right.
He didn't. And so that's the spot of anger. That's where the anger for me comes from.
Still there? This has been a few years.
It's been almost 8 years.
Yeah.
And you know what's funny? If I get talking or if I get experiencing certain places and certain things, I believe it's mine forever. I don't think it ever goes away.
Hmm.
And it's almost you might look at it as a jaded piece of my life or my heart or the way I now look at the world. It might be.
Mm-hmm.
It also might be a gift to me. And I feel I hold both of them at the same time. And before I used to believe it was one or the other. I believed and I had this unbelievable, you know, faith and assurance of God and who He is, or I didn't. Now I am well aware that that is something I hold together. I hold this disappointment, rage, anger and frustration with Him and how He thinks. And at the same time, I hold an absolute delight and awe and joy. It is my very being. It's the very reason I get up in the morning. And I hold both of them. They're both in me. And if you touch the right place,
you'll
get them. Yeah.
Okay, so be careful which button you push.
But I am getting better at learning how to express it. That I would say.
When I first started to gather material for this particular edition of Listening In, I phoned Jamie Howison to ask him what other books we might consider discussing. Almost without hesitation, he said, oh, we need to discuss A Grief Observed by C.S. Lewis and a book written by Nicholas Wolterstorff called Lament for a Son. And here's why.
Lewis's Grief Observed is probably the better known to folks who are listening. Wolterstorff's is a very similar kind of a book. They're both books, fairly short, very personal books, written by established, respected theologians in response to crises of grief and death. Lewis writing in response to the death of his wife, and Wolterstorff writing in response to the death of his adult 25-year-old son, Eric. And these are both writers who have got reputations as deeply faithful theologians and spiritual writers. And so there's a kind of some of those expectations of the kinds of things that maybe they should be able to bring to bear in the face of crisis. And maybe we would expect that Lewis would be able to stand completely firm and strong given what he reflected on in the problem of pain and how, you know, what a rock he was to people in their crises.
He'd already taught us about the proper responses to those things.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. And in fact, what happens in both books is that you find these deeply faithful, godly, thoughtful, educated men, their world falls apart. Right. And it's not fair to say that their faith falls apart, because they both engage faith deeply in these books. But a lot of their assumptions and a lot of the things that they would have expected or you might have expected them to be thinking or writing or feeling are all just blown to the wind. Lewis lived most of his life as a bachelor. Lived in Oxford, worked in Oxford, wrote from there, was wildly popular as a teacher and as a public lecturer and as a broadcaster on the BBC. The Second World War is on, but he has got some safety and security from his space in Oxford. And he's enormously helpful to people in that time of deep crisis. His BBC broadcasts through the Second World War were very, very important in affirming for folks faith in the face of this bleak, bleak reality they were living. Marvelous thing happens to him late in life. He falls in love, and it's a kind of it's almost a fairy tale romance. It's wildly unlikely. Some of his friends found her rather base and crass, but he was just enchanted.
Yeah.
And when he realized he'd fallen in love with her, he was completely uprooted. Lots of what he'd thought about and reflected about and written about on romance and eros and love all of a sudden wasn't so dispassionate and from arm's length. He was in the middle of it, and it was just a joy.
Yeah.
And then, of course, she dies.
Right.
They were married in the hospital. She had cancer, and that's the moment he realized he was in love with her. And they married at the hospital bed.
Oh, I missed
yes.
that part of the story.
Yep. They had a civil marriage a year or two earlier, just so she could emigrate and stay in England. But it was just a civil marriage. He saw it as an agreement. And they didn't live together. And he didn't consider them really married, because it hadn't been blessed by the church.
Right.
And they were great friends. And then she ended up in the hospital, apparently dying of cancer. And he realized he was in love with her. And they were married bedside. The marriage was blessed by an Anglican priest that they managed to convince to do this rather unorthodox thing. And then cancer went into remission. And they had a 3-year wonderful adventure. I mean, in his reflections on it,
it was a bit of a sucker punch, wasn't it, in a sense?
But I mean, he was just so pleased when and he felt himself to be truly alive for the first time in his life.
Right.
This 3-year romance was the stuff of fairy tales. It was so extraordinary. And he just engaged it. And like I said, everything that he had written about romance and eros, he experienced it.
Right.
And there it all was. And then she got sick again. And there was no, it was beyond treatment. And she died. And all of a sudden, he was faced with the problem of pain as he'd never been faced with it before. And it devastated him.
Well, what I find interesting about, on your suggestion, I hadn't read A Grief Observed before. So I went and read it. And I was really expecting a bit more of a disengaged thinking about grief and thinking about suffering, and I realized that this book in particular, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, was written within days and weeks of her death, and it's not so much about woundedness; it's the wound itself.
Yeah,
it's not like look at my hands or look at my feet. It's no, put your finger in it. It's this book seems to be more like here's the wound, you need to touch it.
Well, it's
or close the book.
Yeah, it's written as it's written as personal journals. These are his notebooks as he's trying to make sense of the experience. And there wasn't necessarily any intention to publish.
Yeah.
And when it's published under a different name, the first go-round. The second edition comes out under his name.
Because he says such odd things for a man who is really a defender of faith, you know, like things like, don't come talking to me about the consolations of religion, or I shall suspect that you don't understand. You know, that line struck me, and it's very raw.
It's extremely raw, and I mean, it's his personal journals. And he goes through a process of wondering if God isn't simply a cruel jester. He goes through the process of wondering why in heaven's name this all happened in the first place. He'd experienced falling in love as a gift, as sheer grace, and being brought to a level of aliveness that he'd never known before. And 3 years later, she dies. And so he writes, O God, God, why did you take such trouble to force this creature out of its shell if it is now doomed to crawl back, to be sucked back into it?
To be sucked back.
Yeah, and I mean the sense of if this romance was grace, was a gift that was going to make him more alive than he'd ever been before, why was she allowed to die for me just to collapse in on myself again and be more dead than anybody could ever be? And I mean, it's all there. It's all written in that kind of raw language.
Yeah,
and he struggles to try to figure out if any of his solutions to the problem of pain written 20 years earlier dispassionately make any sense. And he's, no, they don't.
Right.
Not in the face of what's really happening. And all he can do is name the disaster, scream the pain, rail at God, and begin a slow, slow process of trying to walk again.
When you pass through the fire, you pass through humble, you pass through a maze of self-doubt. When you pass through humble, the lights can blind you, some people never figure that out. You pass through arrogance, you pass through hurt, you pass through an ever-present past. And it's best not to wait for luck to save you, pass through the fire to the light. Pass through the fire to the light. Pass through the fire to the light. It's best not to wait for luck to save you. Pass through the fire to the light.
So far, we've spent a bit of time discussing mostly A Grief Observed, a book by C.S. Lewis, but I can't commend enough as well Nicholas Wolterstorff's book Lament for a Son, which was written in response to the death of his boy, Eric. But in particular, what got me about this book was a question he asks in the middle, and as a musician, of course, this grabbed my attention. as he's trying to deal with the death of his boy, and he's looking for resources, and he says, I tried music. But why is this music also affirmative? Has it always been like that? And then he asks a bit later, is there no broken music? Here again is Jamie Howison.
As you pass through the fire, your right hand waving, there are things you have.
Well, there is broken music. It may not be the broken music you're expecting. There's music born of brokenness that gives expression to hurt and sorrow, right, but may still be quite beautiful. But there is music that is itself broken. Walter Storff's distinction is maybe kind of understood in terms of the distinction between his book and Lewis's book. His own book is born of brokenness, but in a sense it's a seamless kind of a treatise. It is a sustained theological reflection, ultimately. Lewis's is a broken book in many respects. It's choppy. It kind of goes for the jugular sometimes. It jumps. It is unfinished. It has about itself a kind of a broken quality. Sometimes I think people who are feeling that ache to have somebody express their brokenness, not just in the word but in the actual medium.
Well, it seems like brokenness sort of suggests a bit of chaos, does it not? Things aren't neat, things aren't tidy, aren't necessarily even definable or wrap-upable.
Well, yeah, maybe you don't even have the words yet to do much more than to shout or to weep or to yell or to scream.
Well, when you think of contemporary music now, when you think of what came out of Seattle with bands like Nirvana, interesting, when I was talking to Chris Vai earlier, he said that the music that ministered to him off the top, when he first heard that he had Lou Gehrig's and he was going to die, what ministered to him was a Kurt Cobain song, Nirvana. It was nothing out of the Christian tradition. Now, what's with that?
Well, yeah, you certainly don't expect that this angry young musician who ultimately shot himself in despair, who played ugly music in lots of respects with ugly, angry lyrics would be a bearer of grace to somebody who's just found this out. But I think, like Lewis, who in his rawness touches notes for people, resonates for people who are going through that, Kurt Cobain and Nirvana at that moment were touching the right chords for Chris. They validated the things that he was beginning to feel. They gave it kind of a voice and expression, gave him something to hang on to.
Named the monster.
That's right. And I mean, part of our tradition, certainly our Old Testament tradition, is you have to tell the truth about the disaster before you can sing the song of new hope. That's what the prophets always do. It's just surprising, maybe, that it comes from a Kurt Cobain or a Lou Reed.
Right.
You know, we heard that piece at the beginning of this interview.
Patti Smith. I think of, in the Christian tradition, the only person that jumps at me right away that might write this kind of lament would be Bruce Colburn.
Yep, and he does. I think the more that I reflect on the sort of the whole body of stuff that he's released, there is a fair bit of his recorded material that has about it a dissonance or a discomfort in the very sound. It's beautifully done, and it's often it's always beautifully played, but there is sometimes a discomfort in some of those songs when they're giving expression to hard emotions, hard feelings, deep anger, hopelessness. The one that really stands out, and this is the one that I sort of latched onto instantly when we began to talk about this, was You Get Bigger As You Go from the Humans album back in the early 80s, which You Get Bigger As You Go is the burden, the chaos, the nothing,
the drag.
Emptiness, the drag of the stuff that he's working out in the aftermath of a collapse of his marriage and the collapse of his, his dream, his life as he knew it. And it's this collection of sometimes ugly images that he just sort of throws one after another after another after another, and then it's You Get Bigger As You Go. You Get Bigger As You Go. And you can almost feel the weight. You can hear the dissonance in his voice. You can feel the brokenness of that experience. And that song kind of ends there. It doesn't come back around and affirm.
Right.
But in the big picture,
it's
necessary. Sometimes you have to name the disaster that rawly and just stop and sit with it.
So I find out what the luxury of hate is, as exciting maybe as doing the dishes, face toward window. Walk away to see a film, see some people, see a man stabbing throat, twisting gut, all too clear, not too new, all been done before. Planet breathes exhaustion, staggers on, enemy anger, impotent gun grease, too many thoughts, too dog shit tired, one small step for freedom from foregone conclusion. You get bigger as you go. No one told me, I just know. Bales of memory like boats in tow. You get bigger as you go.
I've asked my father to tell you a story I think contributes to the content of this magazine. Dad used to be a chaplain at Drumheller Federal Penitentiary in Drumheller, Alberta, and the story concerns a volatile inmate who chose my father and his office as the appropriate place to blow off some steam.
Yeah, that's a very vivid story. I had a fellow come to the door of my office. It was his very first chaplaincy. It was in Drumheller. and knocked on the door. I told him to come in. He opened the door, held on to the door handle with the door open, sort of half stepped into the office and started to yell at me and swear at me. In fact, he went on for a full 5 minutes. It was just one awful volley of how terrible I was, how bad things were, and quite threatening in a number of ways, too. At the end of that particular volley, I sort of sat back as listening, and I said, is that all you want to say? And it wasn't, so I got another 3 minutes of absolute volley. All the time, he held on to the door handle. Very aggressive, very threatening, but hanging on to the door as if I could run any second. And it was only after he had really vented that I could say to him, why don't you come in, we'll talk about it. And it became very important because for what he needed to tell me was he's an sexual offender, very dangerous man. And what he wanted to do was ask me to see if we could stop him from getting out, that we could somehow hold him back because he knew if he got out, he would rape again and this time maybe kill somebody. But underneath of all that pain, all that hassle came this huge aggressive talk.
Well, you know what? So what I remember in this story when you told me when I was a little boy, because you told me the story, I was a drum heller, so I would have been between 8 and 12. And I remember just the offense that some guy would come into your office and start yelling at you and threatening you with aggressive language. And I remember saying to you, Dad, weren't you offended? Do you remember what you said back?
No, I think I couldn't remember exactly what I said, but the idea was that it's really a compliment that this fellow, with all his rage, with all his fear, with all his pain, looking around all over the place, decided, where's the safest place I could blow? And it was my office.
So it was
and
a trust.
He chose me. It was a tremendous honor, despite the fact that from the outside it looked like it was aggressive.
Well, I guess this is what I'm getting at, because I've thought about this story many, many times. Do you think the church is perceived as a safe place for people that need to blow? And then I guess the second, obviously I'm suggesting it probably ought to be. And then the question is, if that's true, how does that flesh out? How does that become that such a place?
I wished it were a safe place.
Yeah.
And way back, churches were a house of refuge. People could come in and if they were being chased by the government, they could stay there for refuge.
Right.
Unfortunately, quite a number of our churches tend to want to have a church where everything is nice, and they have a hard time being a safe church because it means then you have to listen to that kind of pain. Mm-hmm. And we tend to get very offended rather than hear the depth of what's coming on. But we do need to move that way because there's a tremendous authenticity when those people are talking that way.
Well, it seems that almost the presence of anxiety and despair amongst Christians is like almost a threat to our faith, and we're afraid of it, rather than realize in the community of faith that's probably maybe the safest and best place to express it, no?
It ought to be.
Yeah.
And it's the most exciting thing. It's the song that you wrote from David, Why Have You Forsaken Me, O God?
Right.
David felt that safe in the presence of God.
Right.
And of all the places in the world that I should be able to vent my spleen, my anger, my frustration, my fear, it ought to be in a holy place where that doesn't dominate my life, but the grace of God comes over the top of my spleen, my anger, my fear, and my doubts.
Hmm. What do you think is a result of our churches not being such a place?
You know, I've often been haunted by that. Because that fellow said to me, you know, if you don't stop me from getting out, the next time I'm going to rape somebody, I may kill them. And frankly, if he had not found anybody safe, if we couldn't have taken measures, and he had gone out on parole and killed somebody, nobody would have known that I, as a pastor, wasn't a safe person. It would have never come back to me.
Right.
But somebody in this country would be dead. And the trouble with this kind of stuff is when we fail to be a safe place, we never become aware, or very seldom do we become aware, of the damage done because the person did. didn't have a safe place to deal with whatever struggles going on.
We're not held accountable.
No way.
There's no trace.
And that's an incredible tragedy. Mm-hmm. The church has to be bigger than that.
You've been listening to Volume 2 of Listening In Audio Magazine. For more information on our work, please contact us at 1-800-854-3499 or visit us at steve-bell.com. If you can't find at your local bookstore the books referred to in this presentation, please call our friends at Hall's Family Bookstores. Their contact information, along with ours, is printed in the liner notes. Finally, Chris Vai, who will get the last word in just a minute, writes a quarterly journal of hope and healing called For Words. Subscription information for his publication is also found in the liner notes. Thanks for listening in. I'm your host, Steve Bell.
So anyway, this happened on Sunday, and the end of the sermon, we had read the call of Moses in Exodus 3, and it's where Moses encounters God in this mysterious bush that's on fire, and at a certain point he says, "What's your name? Like, who are you? What are you all about?" Right.
I love that.
And there's this weird answer. It's like a cryptic response. I am who I am.
Yeah.
That's who I am. Yeah. I just am. God is. Well, Martin Buber, a Jewish theologian who studied that passage in Hebrew all his life, came to the conclusion that we've been mistranslating that in English, in our English Bibles, and that rather than God's name being I am who I am, the name of our God is I shall be there.
Oh.
I shall be there is a more accurate translation of the Hebrew. So think of that.
Yeah.
The name of our God is I shall be there. So from the moment we're born and dedicated to God or baptized into the faith, the name of our God is I shall be there. And I ask the congregation to respond that as almost like a litany. Say it. I shall be there. You can do better than that. The name of our God is, I shall be there. And they shouted it out. And then I said, the ministry and mission of this church is to reach out in the name of Christ and to heal those who are hurt and to touch those who are in need. And the name of our God is, I shall be there. And whether we go through heartbreak or heartache, sadness or sorrow, the name of our God is, I shall be there. Whether we are touched by disease or difficulty, brokenness, frustration, the name of our God is, I shall be there. And when we're laid out in the grave, the last breath goes out of our bodies, the name of our God is, I shall be there. And then, on that resurrection morning, when the trumpet's blaring and a million suns shining in the sky, the name of our God is,
I shall be there.
That's trust.